Got it.
Got it.
Tom Tangney here, not John Curley. This is the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley away for the day, we presume, and Felix Bonnell filling in. Again, thanks on relatively short notice, Felix. Thanks for doing this again. It's always fun.
Got it. Got it.
You know, one thing that John does, I've noticed all the time, like to transition to another story, he'll say that the fact that people like mustard more than mayonnaise is setting some people off. You know. So I might just start saying the fact that when I want to transition to something else.
Yes. That's perfect. Somebody wrote in the other day, maybe it was last week, saying, why does John always say got it? Why does he start the hour saying got it? It's one of those inexplicable things that happens on the Tom Curley Show.
It's like, I think it's based on Car Talk and those two brothers who say, like, you know, Cambridge, Mass, our fair city.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
little inside radio there, sorry.
Anyway, yes, may one of them rest in peace. One of them is still alive, but a great, great show. Okay, so we're going to get a twofer today from the hardest working woman in show business and or the reporting business. Let's introduce Hannah Scott, everybody. Greetings, Hi. Hannah.
Hello. How are you guys?
So I love the story you're about to tell us about people serving life with parole and their adjusted sentences. But before we do that, let's hit up the governor at another press conference. I assume that you monitored that. Any news of value at that press conference?
Yeah, a little bit of news for a value. He came out, and this was kind of just a general availability that he did. So he hit a couple of different things. First came out and, of course, had to give a kind of a consolatory shout out to the Zags after the game. And that was first.
Consolation.
First order
Too soon.
Of business.
Too soon.
Too soon. But then he turned to not the pandemic first. He wanted to go and discuss some issues about homelessness. He said that, you know, the problem has only gotten worse, obviously, in the pandemic, and that's one thing that's happened. But at the same time, we've got this opportunity for federal dollars that have just come from this latest stimulus bill. So here's what he wanted to say.
I think that mutual investments and partnerships going forward should focus on strategies getting people off the street and under a roof with dignity and privacy. And that these facilities can have access to services like housing counseling to keep people under a safe roof. We hope that these increased investments will be made in mutual partnership with counties, cities, and towns across our state that actually are implementing these programs. So it is our hope, and I believe legislators' reasonable expectations, is that communities that would receive these additional funds that we will be proposing will have effective program strategies and implementation plans that will effectively transition people out of our public parks and right-of-ways and into secure housing that has the privacy that we know has been so effective.
So here's basically, he kind of backs into it, but what he's saying is we're already into the budget proposals and actually negotiations in the legislature right now. Both budgets, the House and the Senate, included a lot of money and also some stimulus money that was being used towards homelessness, but not enough for the governor. He wants more. So he's asking at this late date for them to put some more dollars in the budget for the specific purpose. Here's a little more about what he wants to see.
Specifically, I am proposing that the legislature appropriate federal American Rescue Plan dollars toward rapidly acquiring housing units, providing case management, and cleanup and rehabilitation of public spaces that have been used as encampments. This is an additional to the original budget requests I have made, in addition to the significant commitments that have already been made by the legislature.
So wait, that's money coming in, but it's not an actual, there's not necessarily a policy directive or there isn't necessarily the infrastructure in place to do what he's talking about. There's just the money to possibly fund it.
Well, that's what he said there in that first cut, is that the communities that will benefit from this money are
it's
going
to
need, they need to have that in place already. This is supposed to be a rapid rollout. And if you can't tell from what he's saying there, this is it's essentially parallel to the charter amendment we just got in Seattle that they're trying to do. It's almost identical to that. And the idea is they've got this money. What I didn't hear, though, is, I mean, this would be one-time funding, so it's about, again, you're not going to wait to build, like, a shelter or something new. You're going to buy housing, and that's kind of where that focus is buying up hotels, motels, spaces, wherever you can get people off the streets in a quick fashion, basically. And get them those wraparound services.
Which does require, I mean, that does require ongoing annual expense to manage those things properly. I do a lot of, I do some video production work for the King County Housing Authority, and I've been following, like, public housing efforts for a long time. And, I mean, that stuff just doesn't, you can't just buy it and then just set it aside. You get, those have to be actively managed, and that's not inexpensive necessarily.
No, it's not inexpensive, but they've got this opportunity to use this money now, and then there's a clock on the funds from this, from the stimulus bill, right? They have so long to use it. So I don't know quite what, where this came from or why he decided to put this out there today, but it's, you know, it's a good idea, and it could make a difference, I think, the same as the charter amendment, if that ended up going through, if that you get people off the streets in a quick fashion. And there are some cities and some counties that have these kind of wraparound services and things already up, or they contract with these folks. So I think what the idea is just to have more money to contract with more of them and buy more hotels or whatever spaces they might use, tiny homes and whatnot.
And on the pandemic front, I just was hearing our top of the news with Aaron. We may be rolling back in some counties.
We may be rolling back in some counties. So after he got through the homelessness, he was ready to talk pandemic.
The more folks that aren't wearing a mask, the more folks that aren't socially distancing, the more karaoke parties we have, like I read about in a county south of here that has now had a spike in part of that. Just letting our guard down is really, really dangerous, and we believe it is one of the reasons these numbers are increasing. So this is a critical moment, as it has been all year, to remain committed to those non-pharmaceutical interventions. The vaccine's great, but if these numbers skyrocket, that vaccine is not going to bail us out.
And the numbers are already, you know, going way, way up. Yesterday, I think he called an explosion of cases. I haven't seen today's numbers yet, but they definitely have been trending the wrong way, back above 1,000. I think yesterday was above 1,500 for at least a week now. So, and other states have seen similar things, although he did get into a discussion about California was not seeing that for whatever reason. But but we're in trouble. I mean, there's some counties in the state. I think the number I saw yesterday for Whitman County was like 379 cases per 100,000 people. There are counties already above the threshold for going back a phase to phase two. And, you know, he didn't come right out and say it. They're going to say it when they look at the numbers on Monday, which is what they do. And he did make clear it's whatever the numbers say, that's what's dictating whatever happens. It's not me. And I would be shocked if we don't have several counties go back a phase.
Yeah. And channeling John Curley in his honor, since he's not here, I have to ask this question. John would be quick to point out that, okay, so they are on the rise, but we're nowhere near having a run, you know, in the ICU units and all of this. That why is there a need to shut down or go back when it's clearly not as bad as it was at its worst? Correct.
It's not as bad as it was at its worst, but it's still worse than some of the time that we've seen. First of all, it's worse than it was at the beginning. Still, it's not as bad as the biggest wave that we had. But the concern is always going to be a couple of things. One, hospitalizations are on the rise, and they have been for the last since mid-month, is what I've been told, in King County, in Snohomish County. And the numbers are not astronomical. It's the trend, right? And if that trend keeps happening, if that growth keeps happening, then you end up getting the exponential growth, and then everybody's in trouble. That's once you get to exponential growth, so they get very concerned.
You can even get exponential growth even though a third of us are vaccinated. Vaccinated now? See, that's
20%. 20% still of us are vaccinated.
The dominant variant right now is more easily transmitted than the previously dominant variant. I mean, they're about a week or two ahead of us in British Columbia. They shut down like last week. They shut down, went back a few notches, just like what's probably going to happen here. They did that in Canada last week.
Crucially, though, in Canada, they're way behind us in terms of vaccines. I just keep thinking as bad. I mean, I've never minimized the threat of COVID-19. I think John is more on that side of the ledger. But it does seem to me that whatever threats are happening, given the fact that so many of us are getting vaccinated, and if our vaccinations are like 90% good, I just think that the peak is not going to be nearly what it was pre-vaccination, and we're getting thousands every day of more vaccinations. I'm surprised there's that much alarm, I guess.
There's alarm for a few reasons. One, we've got a shortage. We're not getting the supply that we thought we were going to get because of that mistake at the
vaccines?
The factory, right? So we're not going to be getting as much as
Johnson,
we thought.
Johnson.
And once again, we heard from the governor today, there are a lot of seniors who are not getting their vaccines. There is hesitation on the eastern side of the state for people getting vaccines. That's a problem. And I can't say this enough, and I've been saying it since the beginning, and the variant is a big deal. I think the UK variant is the dominant strain now, and it is also, it's more transmissible, and it's also been proven to be more deadly in some cases. Beyond that, it's still only been a little over a year, guys. They don't know enough about this. And that is always why you're going to get some of that hesitation. I want to point out, though, while he did indicate that we could see some counties go back to phase two on Monday, that will not mean the closure of any businesses. That would mean a reduction in capacity. Okay. So it'll just be like 25% instead of 50%.
Instead of 50%. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good enough. Okay. Felix, do you have any last questions? Because I want to get to this interesting story about the resentencing if we have had
time. Let's go for it. Let's go for it.
Okay. So the floor is yours, Hannah.
Thank you. There's a lot of stuff going on in the legislature, and a big part of it is criminal justice reform. There are a bunch of bills. This is one of the biggies. It has to do with the three strikes law. And essentially, I don't know if you remember, I think it was a session or two ago where the legislature passed a bill to end, I think it's first-degree robbery or second-degree robbery.
Second-degree, yeah.
Second-degree robbery, remove that as one of the three strikeable offenses, which it had been for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this concern at the time, well, if they do this now, then they're going to end up wanting to do something more later. But what they did a couple of years ago, it was a moving forward bill, right? So it was anybody from now on, you won't get the third strike for this.
Right.
But there was nothing to do for those who were still sitting in jail because they had their third strike that was a second.
Nothing
degree.
Retroactively.
Right. Nothing retro. Yeah. So that's what this does. It addresses that so that there's a handful of people, I think, still serving time because that was one of their three strikes. And this will get them out of prison. And it's just a little over 100 people, I think. But it led to some feisty debate on the floor.
That a previous legislature passed the three strikes law because people in Washington state were tired of persistent offenders.
I would love the opportunity to go back and restore justice for those that were improperly sentenced under a three strike law for committing robbery one. We all don't always have an opportunity to right the wrongs that we were a part of. This bill is not a miscarriage of justice. This bill brings proportionality, which is a fundamental part of justice.
So this will have all of those 114 people it is that are still serving time because they had one of these as their third strike or one of their three strikes will be resentenced now. And it could be their path out of jail. So I think the judges have discretion and can look at, the totality of whatever their situation was with all three strikes. But if they weren't as bad as one might think, then perhaps you're going to leave.
From what I've read about this, this isn't like, they get a get out of jail a free pass.
No.
What it does is it returns. So we had the three strikes law says that you have life in prison. You still have to serve time. In fact, the Seattle Times article interviews a guy who's been in prison for like 14 years. And he figures if he gets this three strikes your law out out from under him. He still has to serve like another 7 years. He's still going to send like 20 years in prison. It's just at that point, he has hope of getting out, right? This
and
is not something
difference.
Like opening
no, yeah,
all
you're
the...
You're not getting a free release. That's what
right.
you... It requires resentencing. So again, it will be up to the judge. They'll have to look at the sentencing and, numbers and things like that.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing, too, that in terms of the compromise, in order to get enough votes, that this still, it's not like automatically, okay, if you've been convicted of a second-degree robbery, we now, you know, take that off the list. You now have to have a judge look at each and every one individual case and then resentence them so that some mm-hmm. may be getting off carte blanche, and I don't mean that they don't have to serve time, but they do not have to have it credited. It sounds like they think, well, maybe this could justify a third strike, even if in the law we're now saying it's only a second-degree burglary isn't a third strikeable
offense. Do you remember that campaign, Tom, back in the early 90s? It passed with something like 76% of a yes vote. It was a ballot measure to pass that law. And it was in the wake of a lot of really sensational crimes where people
who would have
been locked up had committed
stuff. Well, in the crime bill in Congress, I mean, this is the early 90s.
It's sort of a hangover from that period that we're sort of reassessing right now. And it's a few hundred people, so it makes sense that... To reevaluate this.
And it's a few hundred people that are disproportionately people of color. That's what's driving this.
Exactly.
That's the problem. Yeah. And you've got multiple prosecutors who are concerned about that. Adam Cornell, the prosecuting attorney for Snohomish County, is concerned. And he likes the law, right? I know him, and he likes to get people on the right path. But if you break the law, he wants you to do your time. But he also is very concerned about the disproportionality that we've seen with specifically the laws like this. This is the law, the three strikes law, came from that era that you guys were talking about with the crime bill and all of that, the tough on crime, the war on drugs. All of that literally was so disproportionately affecting people of color, specifically black people, who have now suffered generational harms is the argument because of that.
And the next step, they say, the people that are moving this, they would like to consider dropping the second-degree assault as a third-strike qualifier as well. I understand from the Seattle Times article that not everybody, like you mentioned this, Cornell, he's not ready to sign off on that categorically, that should be included. But that could be the next shoe to drop.
Sure, and there's going to be some pushback on stuff like that because there are people in the legislature who are state lawmakers who really want just about everyone out of prison because it's not been proportional and because they don't believe it creates better public safety for people to have that hope, for people to go back and have a chance to do something with their lives and things like that. You just keep the worst of the worst in prison. So you're going to get those kind of proposals. How many of them pass, we'll see.
Yeah, next session, maybe.
Next session, not this year.
That's terrific. Okay, thanks a lot, Hannah, for your great reporting, as usual.
You guys.
All right, and now we turn to Tracy Taylor to let us out of our traffic prison. Technical difficulties are there. Welcome.
Got it.
I'm listening to my cue, and the cue, the sound faded away, so I didn't know if I was even on the station or not. So, you are listening, if you can't tell already, to the Tom and Curly Show without one of the Tom and Curlys. Tom Tangney here, John Curly away. We assume he'll be back by tomorrow, and Felix Spinell is filling in. So this next story we have lined up, thank you to Jacob, is somewhat similar to something that John and I did yesterday, Felix. We talked about this book called Remember, and it's all about the role of memory in our lives and how tricky memory can be, and that every time, basically, the memory is your imagination. And every time you remember things, you misremember them even more until there's this polished sheen to the apple, as John always talks about, that really is might not even be that close to reality, but
John's case.
Exactly. But boy, does that apple shine. So nobody complains. Right. And so we now have a story. Jacob found us this story, again, based on a book all about time and our perception of time, which I found absolutely fascinating. Why time slows down when we're afraid, speeds up as we age, and gets warped on vacation. And there's this book called Time Warped, Unlocking the Mysteries of Time Perception. And this, though we were laughing in the pre-show, that all three of us are talking about, oh yeah, and I like this part, and I like that part, that we could, not that there'd be any interest in it, but the three of us could talk about this for an hour, for 2 or 3 hours. Don't worry, we'll only do this one segment on it. But I think just to kind of set up the article, let's talk about the one theory, because we can dispense with it. It's a truism that we can dispense with relatively quickly, and then we get on to the more interesting aspects of it. But this is something about why is it that when we look at our lives, we feel like life goes so slowly when we're young and so fast as we get older. I mean, you know, a 2-year span when you're 5 years old feels like eternity. Summer alone feels like an eternity, whereas when you're in your 40s, it feels like, oh my God, that year just flew by. Why is that? There is something called the proportionality theory, which they say its proponents are people as Augustus, William James, and Vladimir Nabokov. And that's it. That the idea is when you're 8 years old, a year makes up 1/8 of your entire experience. So, wow, whereas when you're 40, it only represents 1/40th of your experience. Mm-hmm. So just the whiz factor is established there, that you've just had so many more experiences. And because of that, it's a smaller and smaller slice of your life. Now, the way they discount that is they say that fails to account for the way we experience time at any one moment. And they mentioned, so if you really were a 40-year-old and every day is just one, they point out, if you go through a single day, it's like 1/14,000th of your life, that every day would just whiz by, that there would be no sense of boredom. And they said, that's certainly not true. Life can still feel long and boring on particular days, and a fun day, at the seaside, as they put it, naturally, goes by faster than when you're waiting in line at the airport or something. That experiential aspect of time isn't recognized by that slice of just 1/40th. It ignores attention and emotion.
The proportionality theory is pretty much debunked, is what these guys are
exactly
saying, right?
But
there is something about age and memory, though, right? And this was one of the fascinating parts of this article, this notion of the reminiscence bump, which is that things that happen to you or things that you remember from between the ages of about 15 to 25 are always going to have a higher profile in your mind. That might feel like nostalgia or good memories, or that things were better or more intense. And it's true. There is this reminiscence bump for that 10 years. And there's something about this that, I mean, we talked about this in the pre-show meeting, this notion of films, right? That people who of a certain kind of, they tend to like films that are from those 10 years of their life, right?
In fact, a lot of film critics have talked about this. Oftentimes, their favorite film of all time happened in those years, in your college years, maybe your late high school, pre-college, your graduate school years, around, in your early 20s. And why is that? They say that part of that has to do with this novelty that you are forming. It's a new experience, because when you are graduating from high school, you're suddenly becoming an adult and you're creating your own identity. And so the first sexual relationships you have, your first jobs, your first travel without parents, those are really crucial to who you are. And because they have so much value in identifying who you are to yourself, you hang on to them, maybe long past your need for it. It's that strong impact on memory that happens in those crucial growing up years.
Yeah, I've noticed. I've been going back and watching some movies from about the time when I was that age to show them to my daughter, say movies I really, really liked. And there have been some real disappointments, like, oh, my God, why did I like this movie so much? Or where it just wasn't funny anymore. Like, you ever see that John Waters movie, Crybaby, with Johnny Depp?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I saw that like 3 times in the theater. Yeah. It was like I could recite lines from it. And I hadn't watched it for 20 years, and I watched it about 6 months ago, and it was like, oh, my gosh, what did I see in this? So.
Well, that's the other thing. That's sort of like your corrective take too. That you have a different impact. But they also, I just like this whole notion of novelty. One of the reasons why they say, why do vacations make such a bigger impression on you than you could work for a whole year and you could even love your job, but the 3 weeks you take off to go someplace or do something different stands out more significantly than 10 months of doing anything. And they say it's just because of the novelty. The novelty tends to override and make time seem to go faster, because because it is a new thing. Now, they don't talk about novelty as a, you know, and what if it's a bad thing? Like, you know, one could argue that the novelty of the pandemic, trauma, exactly. But this idea of that our measurement of time is so based on our brain that it's not really the physical component that makes time, like your 1/8 of your life, if you're only 8 years old, how long a year is. But it's more the sensation and how it impacts your brain, how much attention you're paying on it. And again, just to kind of recap this, because it's way too rich for us to do more than just skim the surface. But for instance, they mentioned that people, so if you think of your ages between 15 and 25 are the most crucial for you in terms of the most strongly identified years. They mentioned that, so let's say something significant happens to you in your 40s that really changes how you see yourself. Like they mentioned, some people came out of the closet in their 40s, that it's then those years right around a 10-year gap where you're re-identifying who you are that are as potent as those 15 to 25 years are for most people, because you are re-identifying who you are, and those become the crucial, that reminiscence bump that we're talking about.
And I'm jealous of the 15 to 25-year-olds listening right now who are going to remember this show so much more fondly than I will.
That's right. I don't think there's a chance any 15 to 25 year old is listening right now.
But if they are, they're having a great time.
That's right. We are forming who they are. Uh-oh, we're in trouble now. Anyway, okay, that's enough. We won't have too many more philosophical discussions on today's show, but at least it does open that that panorama of possibilities for time, memory, and identity. Okay, Tracy, why don't you get back to concrete reality and talk about what's happening on the roads. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curly away. He'll be back tomorrow, we presume, and Felix Pinnell filling in for him. So there's been a story kicking around that's another one of these post-pandemic speculation stories that it makes a lot of sense, I think. The headline was, 1 in 4 plan to bolt job post-pandemic. In the last week or two, Felix, we've been doing stories about how there's a dearth of roadies because for a year there were no live shows to set up and break down, and so they found other other jobs, other ways to make some money, and a lot of them are thinking, you know, this beats that life on the road. Maybe we'll stay with this. We also did a story about a substitute teacher shortage, that a lot of teachers, a lot of substitutes especially, decide, you know, this isn't really for me. A lot of teachers that got into their profession didn't really take to the remote business and figure, I don't want to have to, you know, teach hybrid versions or teach remotely. It's just, it's not what I signed up for. There are also fast food workers that don't want to come back if they found something better, or maybe the stimulus checks have helped to encourage that for now. So there are a lot of impacts on the pandemic on how we think about our jobs, and this makes perfect sense to me. One of the things I see happening is that you begin reevaluating. If you're working from home, and I think I read a percentage, something like 48 or 49% of us, at least here in the Puget Sound region, are working from home during the pandemic, that you begin to see life a little differently, and that maybe your job remotely seems more appealing than your job, you know, on campus. And if they're going to make you come back to campus, you know, you might want to look for something else that would accommodate your remoteness. How about you?
Oh God, if I had to work someplace in an office, I have a weird work career. I have multiple things I do as a contractor,
yes,
as an employee, but none of it involves having to sit through dull meetings. That same meeting every Monday where everyone sort of claims to have made progress on the thing they talked about last Monday. You know, they're just making it up, totally pulling it out. I never go to meetings like that, and I love working from home. And a lot of my work from home is in the field and stuff too. So
yeah,
I can't imagine. There's so many things that are going to happen because of the pandemic that we don't know about yet. We haven't figured out. We won't know till it's upon us or till we look back at it. So this is one of those things, just that mobility of workers and how people value their work life versus their work-life balance. That's all up for grabs right now, I think.
And it's also fascinating to me that, let's imagine, like, I love working at Cairo. I love the people at Cairo. I love the interaction and all of that. So life can be good And the culture can be good in a face-to-face sort of situation. But they say that because a lot of us have been spending a week outside that, whatever kind of stickiness, whatever kind of bonds we might have felt at work, they've weakened over the course of a year. This is certainly not the case for me, but they've kind of weakened. And because of that, more people are willing to jump ship because they feel like, oh, I'm not going to miss, you know, seeing, you know, Larry and Mike and Bill or whomever as much because I haven't seen them face to face for a year. So that's even in good job situations, there is this risk that you might lose some of the best people around. So anyway, that's again, this is all speculation. We'll know more a year from now and 2 years from now how we're going to you know, look back on the pandemic and how it hit our roles. But one person who's never going to go away is Tracy Taylor. There's always going to be a need for Tracy Taylor and traffic.